This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. Depression affects more than 16 million Americans, each of whom has a unique journey to finding treatments that work. Finding what works can often involve lots of trial and error. But what if you don't find anything that works? All trial, all error. It can be scary to give up searching for solutions, especially when depression can be severe enough to threaten your life. So imagine the relief of finding a treatment, even an unconventional one, as one mother told us in our inbox.
This is Eileen from Virginia. My college-age son has suffered from treatment-resistant depression for years now. This winter, he tried the IV ketamine infusions. He did 6 infusions over a 2-week period. At first, we didn't see any change. But after 2 weeks, we saw a marked reduction in his symptoms. It has given him his life back.
Recently, the Food and Drug Administration approved a new drug based on ketamine to treat depression. It's called esketamine, sold in a nasal spray called Spravato. Ketamine IVs have been used to treat depression for years, as well as to cause euphoric highs as a party drug. Take it as a pill. What led the FDA to approve this new medication? Why is it so hard to find an anti-depression regimen that works? And what kind of difference has it made in patients' lives? Joining us from Houston Public Media is Alice Levitt. She wrote about her experience taking ketamine for the website Vox, and she's also a writer who covers medicine. Alice, welcome to 1A.
Hello.
Joining us from Harvard is Dr. Gary Sachs, an assistant professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. Professor Sachs, welcome.
Pleasure to be with you.
And at WSHSHU Public Radio in Fairfield, Connecticut, is Dr. Dimitri Papalos, the co-director of the program in behavioral genetics at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine. He has prescribed ketamine for his patients. Dr. Papalos, glad to have you with us.
Glad to be here.
Before we dive in, we should be clear. This information may help you or a loved one think through your options for dealing with depression, but nothing we'll discuss today is a substitute for a direct diagnosis and treatment plan from your own psychologist or psychiatrist. Having said that, we welcome your questions and your stories. So email us, 1A@WAMU.org, comment on our Facebook page, or tweet us at 1A. Alice Levitt, let me start with you. How did you find out that you had depression? What was that journey like?
Well, I had mild depression from the time I was about 5. And so it was just my state. I was kind of a depressive person, which it's hard to tell for a lot of people because I am upbeat visibly, but I always had an undercurrent. And it was in my late 20s that it started getting more severe. And in 2013, it got to the point that I was starting to have suicidal thoughts. And I treated with oral everything. I tried every antidepressant, really, over about a decade, and nothing worked. And in the past couple of years, I had suicidal thoughts every day. And so it really got to the point that something had to give.
When you say that nothing worked, Alice, did they work to any degree, or did you take them and find no change? How much did they work, even if they didn't work completely?
It was hard to tell because, you know, there is always so much hope that you wonder, oh, well, maybe it's working a little bit. But it never worked to a point that I felt like I should feel.
I want to talk more about your experience with ketamine in just a moment. But first, let's get some basic information. Dr. Sachs, tell us what ketamine is exactly. Some people know it as a party drug, but what is it?
Yeah, ketamine is a molecule that interacts with NMDA receptors. These are excitatory neurotransmitters in the brain. And when we talk about ketamine, we are actually talking about a mixture of both the right-handed form of the molecule, we might refer to as R-ketamine, and the left-handed, which would be S-ketamine. And that is really what people like Alice got when they got it IV. They got the mixture.
Now, what do you mean by right-handed and left-handed? Does that have to do with the structure of the molecule or something?
Yeah, you know, it's just like if you put your hands side by side, they're right, all Both hands have five fingers. They look the same, but they're mirror images of each other. And in nature, many molecules, especially a lot of the drugs that we use, have left and right-handed forms. And some of them actually have very different activity from each other. Sometimes it's all the benefit is conveyed by one. Sometimes both have benefit. Sometimes one has most of the side effects.
Dr. Papoulos, you've been working with ketamine for some time with your patients. Talk about the process that goes into deciding to treat someone with ketamine from when they approach you in need of care to when they actually get the treatment. What's that process like?
Well, we've been studying a particular form of treatment-resistant mood disorder in children for the last 10 years and identified a form that had a biological marker, which was a temperature dysregulation. And this is the most severe form of the disorder that wasn't responsive to any medications that were tried. Based on what we knew about the specific symptoms of the condition, two of them were temperature dysregulation and fear sensitization. We found that ketamine in animal studies had an effect to both improve, reduce fear sensitization and also dose-dependently improve thermoregulation. And about 10 years ago, when there was nothing else, we began trying ketamine in cases that were unresponsive to anything else, and it had a profound effect. At that point, we started using intranasal ketamine. Racemic model, the R and the S form, so combination of both.
Doctor, I just want to back up for just 1 second, just so I know that we're clear. You said that, if I'm hearing you correctly, there were some of the patients, children, who you worked with who had forms of depression that also manifested with symptoms like not being able to quite regulate their body temperature, that their temperature was off as kind of a side effect of what they were dealing with, and you were able to treat them through IVs, through a nasal spray, and it showed promise. It helped them with the symptoms and with the underlying depression. Am I hearing you right?
Well, yes, I would say more than showed promise. It was transformational. The first child that we treated, who was 8 years old, who had severe psychotic symptoms, separation anxiety, had horrendous sleep disorder with nightmares and night terrors. After the first treatment with IV ketamine, which is what she received in a dentist's office who was willing to administer it to her. She was having a dental procedure. She had a phenomenal response and was symptom-free for 2 weeks after about 3 hours after getting the drug. Subsequently, we began using intranasal ketamine on a regular basis because it was really not practical to use intravenous ketamine on a regular basis.
Dr. Papoulos, give me a sense of the people who come to you or to providers in general for treatment with ketamine. I imagine that the folks that you've dealt with have kind of been at the end of their rope, for lack of another way to talk about it. They've tried everything else. They're running out of options, and they're just looking for one more avenue that might work.
Yeah, the children that I see and adolescents have not only been on various courses of stimulants and antidepressants and antipsychotics, but they've been diagnosed with a whole alphabet soup of DSM diagnoses.
DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, the book that defines all psychological illnesses.
Right. But they also all have, the ones that we see, have this thermoregulatory deficit and a very specific set of symptoms that makes them a very homogeneous population within the depressive, you know, the mood disorder world. So it's a specific group that we've been treating. It's not heterogeneous as major depression is in psychiatry.
We're speaking to Dr. Dimitri Papoulos, Professor Gary Sachs, and Alice Levitt about treating severe depression with ketamine. Alice, talk about what it was like for you to take ketamine in this form to treat your depression. How would you describe its impact from the moment you started taking it?
Well, I took it intravenously. So I have not tried the esketamine yet, but
the nasal spray.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I haven't tried that. But I went and sat in, ironically, it was very much like a dentist's chair, and did my first couple of infusions, and I started laughing again. That was really the first thing that I noticed, that I was smiling, I was laughing, I was reacting in ways that I used to, but hadn't in a couple of years. And I did 6 treatments in 2 weeks, as the lady before mentioned her son did, and I had no more suicidal thoughts. I wouldn't say that I had no signs of depression, but it was lifted immeasurably.
Did you start laughing right away?
I would say it was 2 treatments.
Before you kind of started. So it wasn't like the infusion began and within minutes.
No. And the experience of the infusion itself was not pleasant. Mm. Yeah. So that was traumatic in a way.
I want to talk more about that trauma when we continue. Sit tight, Alice. I'll let you finish your story in just a moment as we continue with Alice Levitt, Dr. Dimitri Papoulos, and Dr. Gary Sachs. Madeline emailed, "I'm so glad that the current first guest mentioned that other people might have a hard time believing that she has depression because her overall demeanor is pretty perky and positive. Our inner and outer journeys don't always match one another." Well said. We welcome more of your stories about your journeys dealing with severe depression, 1A@WAMU.org. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We're discussing new treatments for severe depression with writer Alice Levitt, Dr. Dimitri Papoulos, and Dr. Gary Sachs. We'd love to hear from you, too. Comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or email 1A@WAMU.org. Quite a few of you are interested in these stories about ketamine treatment. Heidi tweeted, "I've used Celexa, paroxetine, venlafaxine, Xanax ER, duloxetine, buspirone, and currently sertraline. Side effects versus efficacy made me quit most of them. None seem to work long term. I'm following the story on ketamine, but usage sounds inconvenient at best. I'd love to see more study." We also heard from some people who have used ketamine with great success, including this listener, Austin, who left a note in our inbox.
"I suffer from treatment-resistant depression. I tried almost every medication in the book, including electroconvulsive therapy, and that ketamine was the only thing that ever gave me any relief from my treatment-resistant depression. I think it's kind of a miracle drug, not to be too hyperbolic, but I can say with some confidence that it saved my life."
Yeah, Austin, thanks very much for sharing your story with us. Professor Sachs, I wonder if you could clarify one piece of what Austin said. He referred to electroconvulsive therapy. Can you talk about that and some of the other treatments that had been used to treat severe depression before ketamine really came on the scene and got FDA approved in this form?
Sure. In fact, electroconvulsive therapy has been around since the 30s and 40s and is a highly effective treatment for depression. It preceded the psychopharmacology era, if you will. But the thing that I would emphasize, Joshua, to all of your listeners, is that in the esketamine story, we have moved from testimony to test. Now we have proof, not in one patient's experience, but statistically significant advantage in at least some of the studies that Janssen did. This is an incredible accomplishment because the bar of having results in a randomized clinical trial is actually very, very high. It's what FDA requires. And tempering that enthusiasm, because I love those kinds of results, I also think it's fair to say that in these rigorous trials, there were a lot of people who have histories like you're hearing from the people who are writing in, where they failed multiple treatments, yet 40% or so of them responded to placebo in those trials. And the response rate to esketamine was about 55%. So while that's statistically significant, I think we have to be very careful because there are risks associated with these treatments, and we don't want to get lost in the enthusiasm and the testimonials. We really have to be responsible. We have a duty to inform people about proven treatments, and esketamine now belongs in that club. However, we don't really know the long-term risks very well. We know the ones associated with the party drug version, and we're just beginning to understand this molecule. So we have to be careful.
And I don't want to get too deep into the weeds, Professor Sachs, because we're talking about pharmacology and psychiatry, and I'm not a doctor. But I just want to make sure we're clear for people who've never had to deal with some of these medications, that the tweet we got from Heidi where she mentioned all these different medications, Celexa and duloxetine and sertraline, the differences in them, it sounds like the difference between these other kinds of treatments, well, and ketamine too, are the parts of the brain they work on, the chemicals in the brain and the body that they work on, whether they block them, whether they facilitate them. It's kind of finding the right chemical to affect your biochemistry in a way that eases the depression. Is that kind of a good, super simple way of explaining it?
You know, one thing I think would be helpful to understand is that what Heidi described, that series of drugs, that might be like vanilla and French vanilla and, you know, some double vanilla. But when we start getting to ketamine, you know, we're really talking about a very, you know, we're not talking about just going from vanilla to chocolate, but maybe Jamocha almond fudge and something altogether different. And that's really what is exciting about this molecule.
Miranda asks, if someone takes ketamine for depression, do they still experience hallucinations? Alice, what was your experience?
I absolutely did. And the first treatment that I did, I slipped into what's referred to as a K-hole, in which it's a bad trip, really. And so I did the infusion. It was about 45 minutes long. Around minute 20, I started thinking that I was dying. And
dying.
I could hear, yes, I could feel my body shutting down. I don't know what the phenomenon was exactly that was happening in my brain, but I felt like I could feel my body shutting down. And so I heard beeping, and it turned out that that was actually the machine saying it was done doing the infusion, but I thought that was me flatlining.
That must have been terrifying.
It was. So I really didn't want to do it again, but I was so determined to get better that I tried an additional treatment. It didn't happen again. And so it's not something that happens every time. It's not something that happens to everybody, but it happened to me the first time, and that was very unfortunate.
What you're saying kind of reflects what we've heard from Neil Brennan, who is a comedian who's talked about dealing with depression. He has also had some experience with ketamine. We found a clip from his stand-up special, Three Mics, where he talks about his experience with ketamine. Here is part of how Neil Brennan described what he went through.
I can't explain to you how normal this doctor's office was. Like, a bunch of other people waiting for other doctors, fill out the form, old magazines. They call me back into his office, put an IV in my arm, drip ketamine into it, and I trip my face off. On a Tuesday afternoon in a doctor's office, immobile, out, music festival level, not on this plane, gone. But, and it lasted about 45 minutes, but the come down was rough. Like, when I came out of it, I felt like I just came out of surgery, which makes sense because it is an anesthetic. So I decided not to do it again, and then woke up the next day and felt better than I'd felt in months, and I was like, I gotta do it again. Did it five more times in the next 2 weeks. But yeah, but long term, the side effects from ketamine were bad for me. It was like I got nauseous for months. I was groggy for months. And worse than that, my eyes burnt for 4 months straight. It was crazy. So that didn't work for me.
Neil Brennan from his stand-up special, Three Mics. Alice, how much does that sound like your experience?
I had none of those side effects, so that's new to me to hear that. I had really nothing. I was done with the infusion, and within 20 minutes, I was walking and taking an Uber home and took a nap, but then I went about my business, went out to dinner, had fun. So I had not heard that before, but I guess it's possible, but I had no problems at all.
Dr. Papoulos, what about the variety or the array of reactions that people can have when they're treated with ketamine? Sounds like Alice had one set of experiences. Neil Brennan had a very different set of experiences. Is that just kind of to be expected?
Well, it depends on how much ketamine is administered. I think the last Neil Brennan's description was someone who had received intravenous ketamine, and perhaps it was too much for him to handle, and he had what are called emergence reactions. I've not heard of long-term side effects like that. Ketamine is rapidly metabolized and excreted in the body. The effects are, the potential side effects are gone within an hour and a half usually. The patients that we treated, about 250 patients over the last 12 years, and we use intranasal ketamine not just for 6 weeks, but often for every 3 days. And we have published in the literature data on long-term side effects, although it's not a large sample compared to what we would want to see. And I agree with Dr. Sachs. I think we need much more research on the longitudinal effects of ketamine. It is a sizable sample, and the side effects, the long-term side effects in our study were negligible. There were only one or two people that we had to take off ketamine, primarily because they developed severe truncal acne, which is a known side effect that's been reported, but it was fairly rare. The side effects, and this again is the way you, depending on how it's administered, if you can, in a sense, customize the dose, the intranasal dose for each individual patient, you can pretty much avoid most except for mild dissociative effects. And what we found in children and adults that we've been treating is that over time, people will develop a tolerance for the most part to the acute side effects, and are able to tolerate it fairly well over time. I think it does matter whether you've had a lot of experience and how you administer it. That's one of the problems, among a number of the problems with the S-ketamine, is that because the FDA has been so afraid of diversion of the drug, I gather Janssen was put in the position to market it. They had to create this really all of these hoops to go through, which include waiting for 2 hours after you've taken it in doctor's office, only allowing doctors to prescribe it. With a generic ketamine, the one that's being used, the one that has been used for years in IV treatment and what we've been using, one, it may actually be more potent than the S-ketamine from animal studies that have been recently published, but also that it is the way you can administer it. The S-ketamine, you have three different dosage forms. The highest one is 84 milligrams, I believe. Some people that we treat require up to 250 milligrams, but we gradually get there in kind of a customized approach.
Professor Sachs, I wonder if you could answer a question from Sherry, who asked, can your panel address whether there's a difference in efficacy between the IV and the nasal spray administration of ketamine? Is one more effective than the other?
Yeah, I don't think that there has been a head-to-head, but as Dr. Papoulos was saying, there are dose response curves that we can see, and an equal amount of IV and intranasal ketamine ought to have roughly similar kinds of responses.
glad to hear from several of you who have either used ketamine or are thinking about it. Eileen wrote, I had severe suicidal depression. I actually tried to gouge my wrist while hospitalized. That was when I was sent for ECT, electroconvulsive therapy. It did help tremendously. Without it, I would probably be dead now. However, it hurt my memory. I am now on mirtazapine, which is the first antidepressant pill that has helped, but I would be willing to try ketamine if I could. Chelsea wrote on our Facebook page, Alice's piece inspired me to seek ketamine infusions for my treatment-resistant depression. Within a week, my suicidality was a distant memory. I've been shouting my success story from the rooftops. The only question that remains in my mind is the maintenance infusions. What does the research show about the need for subsequent infusions after the initial 6 appointments? Professor Sachs, could you answer Chelsea's question?
Yeah, you know, I'll answer it really based on my personal experience referring patients as a consultant to ketamine clinics largely. And in doing that, there have definitely been patients who have had a response within the first couple of weeks who stopped and have sustained the benefit for going on a year now. But I would say that is roughly 8 out of about 18 patients that we've referred for ketamine. So it's not everybody who's going to get that. And there is a concern that there will be a requirement for repeated treatments and some data that has suggested that the effect of ketamine can be blocked by the kinds of drugs that also block opiate effects and that there is a risk of dependence. That's why there are all these hoops that the FDA has put in place to monitor ketamine use.
Alice, what was it like for you finding a provider who could do ketamine treatments for you? We got some questions in terms of access. Julie tweeted, the only problem is it's hard to get treatment if you can't afford to go to the doctor. What was your experience like in terms of finding a provider, affording the treatments, and so on?
Well, I fell right into it because I had done a story about ECT at the Menninger Clinic where I did my treatment. And so when I realized that I needed something besides drugs, I called Menninger and spoke to the doctor there who at the time was Justin Coffey. And I said, I need to do something. I'm interested in ketamine. He really preferred the idea of prescribing me ECT at the time. And so I had to argue with him a little bit. And he eventually said, okay, after 2 treatments, if it works, we'll continue with the ketamine. Otherwise, it will be ECT. But in Houston, at least, there are a number of clinics that do ketamine only. But that's always made me a bit nervous.
So it was either...
Go ahead. Oh, well, I think that if you have a doctor who prescribes it and doesn't administer themselves, then it's not too scary. But there's also the option, I believe, of people just going in and doing it. So that seems like not the best idea. I would definitely say speak to more than one doctor, if you can, to make the decision.
I wonder what other factors you also considered, Alice, in terms of your overall mental health. Kelly wrote, personally, meds really mess with me. I never even toyed with the idea of using meds because therapy helped. Exercise was also a huge factor in helping me move forward. It's something I believe everyone forgets to implement for their mental health. Alice?
I have a Peloton. So I have.
You got a bike and a screen yelling at you to pedal faster.
I do, yeah. So I have done plenty of exercise and that didn't help. As a matter of fact, as the endorphins released for me, I would sometimes find myself screaming that it had the opposite effect for me.
Screaming?
And so, yeah, the pain would just release as I was on the Peloton. And so it got to the point that I had to stop exercising. I was in so much psychic pain.
Wow. So you tried everything before you got to ketamine.
I really did, yeah, except the ECT. And thank goodness I didn't have to do that because my concern, as the listener said, was losing my memory, which is incredibly important to me as a writer. And so I was so lucky that I didn't have to contend with that, and that was not a symptom with the ketamine.
We'll continue our conversation in just a moment. By the way, if you or someone you know needs to talk to someone, here's the number for the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. It's 800-273-TALK, 800-273-8255. We'll continue in a moment. Stay close. Back now to our conversation with Dr. Dimitri Papalos, Professor Gary Sachs, and Alice Levitt. Dr. Papalos, I wonder if you could also respond in terms of access to treatments with ketamine. Kathleen asked on our Facebook page, currently there are very tight controls on access to ketamine. What is the likelihood that this treatment will become widely accessible soon? Dr. Papalos?
Yeah, I think there's fairly significant access to intravenous ketamine clinics. They've sprouted up around the country in the last 4 or 5 years. But I would share the concern that was expressed about. I mean, there is this feeling that they're, you know, that they're more interested in. The remuneration that is available, because the cost of doing the treatments is significant, and being referred by someone to, you know, who has evaluated you and can follow you up over time would be probably the best way if you were seeking that particular form. The generic ketamine, which we administer in the intranasally, is available. Any physician can prescribe it. It's made from the crystal in a compounding pharmacy, and there are many compounding pharmacies around the country. The problem is, at least within psychiatry, there's been a great fear for using intranasal ketamine or ketamine of any kind because of its reputation as a party drug, and because there have been significant side effects that have been reported in animal studies, toxicology studies, which is a whole other issue. So there are these restrictions, and the current restrictions that have been put on the version that Janssen has produced are pretty onerous, and the cost is, I understand, up to $3,500 a month for eight treatments. Intranasal racemic ketamine, the combination of the two hands, is very inexpensive, less than $70 a month. And as I said, it can be administered by any physician who prescribes it off-label. We've been, you know, as long as you have good oversight, and that's certainly possible, you know, you can teach somebody how to use ketamine and they can use it at home. I mean, that's basically what we've been doing for years and have not had any problems with that. So it's available. There's a lot of fear and, quite frankly, not a lot of knowledge about it.
Yeah, with regards to that fear, Dr. Papalos, I'm glad you brought that up because one of our listeners wrote, in your promo for today's show, you described ketamine as a party drug. As someone who has benefited from ketamine therapy, I fear that this kind of labeling results in a much harder sell for using the drug to treat depression. Ketamine is predominantly used as an anesthetic, both in humans and animals, and is noted for being used in children and the elderly because of how safe it is. Therefore, I hope you frame the drug primarily as a life-saving anesthetic while acknowledging its recreational use.
Very important point. Excellent point. I think that's absolutely true.
But it is used as a party drug. We can't deny the fact that a lot of people, especially in certain demographics, certain minority cultures, LGBT people, especially gay men, have been devastated by the use of ketamine. So I hear where the listener is coming from, but I also understand the reputation because the reputation is real.
It's real, and there are people who are taking up to 1 to 3 grams of ketamine on a daily basis. They have become addicted to the drug, and it's sad when it's available. It's also the drug that they get is drug that's on the streets. It's cut with who knows what. So I'm not suggesting that we shouldn't be careful and do research on this drug and look at the long-term side effects and be careful about how it's administered. And certainly we wouldn't want to get into the situation that happened recently with the opiate epidemic. Ketamine is a dissociative. Frankly, why anybody wants to take it? There's a brief period of euphoria that occurs, at least with the intranasal ketamine. If you take it in excess, like anything else, it can be deleterious, can be damaging, very harmful to your health. But that's not the way. It would be prescribed by a responsible physician.
Alice Levitt, how much has the stigma around ketamine affected either you or the people around you who know that that's been an effective treatment for you? I also understand you've gotten a big response to the piece that you wrote in Vox. How much does stigma come up?
Well, I think there's so much stigma around depression to begin with, that when I wrote the Vox story, that's what I was worried about, not admitting that I had taken a party drug. And I have met people who have taken ketamine recreationally, and they take a much higher dosage, for one thing, than we do when it's prescribed. So it's a very different experience that I can't speak to. But I really haven't encountered any stigma. In fact, I've had a lot of people also say to me, oh, well, what about other mind-altering drugs? Have you tried those? And of course, I haven't, because those weren't prescribed to me. But there has been quite a lot of talk about it.
With regards to that, Professor Sachs, I also wanted to ask you, in terms of the FDA process of getting this approved, Glenn asked, did anyone note that the FDA lowered its own standards in approving esketamine? Efficacy was only significantly better than placebo in one short-term trial. FDA normally requires efficacy in at least two studies. Professor Sachs, what do we know about the FDA's process of approving this?
Yeah, you know, this process went through an advisory committee where there was a nearly unanimous vote to accept the data. Ketamine, being a novel treatment, had a kind of fast-track status where the rules that were applied to it, or the rules that anything with that kind of status would have been evaluated in the same way. These are all, you know, safeguards that are in place, not just for ketamine, but for all novel treatments.
By the way, we've been mentioning Janssen. Janssen is the company that makes the approved version of esketamine called Spravato. We also did reach out to the FDA, which referred us to the statement it issued when it approved Spravato. The statement is attributed to Dr. Tiffany Farchione, who's the acting director of the Division of Psychiatry Products. And the statement reads in part, quote, "There has been a long-standing need for additional effective treatments for treatment-resistant depression, a serious and life-threatening condition. Controlled clinical trials that study the safety and efficacy of this drug, along with careful review through the FDA's drug approval process, including a robust discussion with our external advisory committees, were important to our decision to approve this treatment," unquote. That, again, is attributed to Dr. Tiffany Farchione of the FDA. You can find the whole statement or a link to it on our website, the1a.org. With regards to other treatments, Professor Sachs, someone else tweeted, "There have been really remarkable things happening with psychedelics in helping people with their mental health, including ketamine, though more research needs to be done." Another listener tweeted, "There are lots of promising treatments for depression, anxiety, and PTSD from drugs we've needlessly banned, from microdosing LSD, MDMA, and even MDMA, ecstasy. Funny how we keep all these helpful treatments out of reach of those who could actually benefit." Professor Sachs, how would you react to that?
Yeah, you know, there are parts of that that I really do agree with. To a degree, this idea of stigmatizing drugs because in uncontrolled use, they've had either negative effects or euphoric effects. We're becoming more sophisticated, and we're realizing that whether we're talking about microdosing LSD or a modest dose of psilocybin, that there may well be benefits for people like Alice, people who have lifelong conditions that have caused an enormous amount of suffering. Yeah, we really believe that there's a right to try these things and learn, and subjecting them each to a rigorous clinical trial and trying to learn how to use them responsibly. I think that's obviously in the public interest.
And I'm sorry, psilocybin, what is that?
That's the active agent in so-called magic mushrooms.
Now, Dr. Popoulos, I wonder also, in terms of all of these medications being available, what the process looks like from your perspective now in looking at some of the underlying issues behind someone's depression, the causes, and whether or not we, or how we strike the right balance between more behavioral treatments, therapeutic treatments that deal with, say, what's going on in someone's life, as opposed to prescribing a medication. I mean, do we run the risk of talking less about the causes of depression as opposed to just medicating the manifestations of it?
Well, I think that we crossed that bridge many years ago. I think what has happened over the last 10 or 15 years for a variety of reasons is that what goes by the name of depression in our diagnostic nomenclature is now something that primarily medications are used to treat if it meets specific criteria. How one determines whether to use, for example, more contemporary treatments like cognitive therapy or to start a medication or to do both, I think in many ways depends on the practitioner and depends on their own education. How one does that, there are studies that I think are looking into that. I don't think it's there's a lot of clarity in my experience about that. I think milder depressions that are not incapacitating, that don't prevent an individual from doing their life, basically, and where there is a clear-cut event or set of events or stressors that have produced the symptoms, that is the clearest situation where you might prescribe more of a psychotherapy approach rather than starting medication.
And Alice, correct me if I'm wrong, you mentioned that your depression began to manifest itself when you were 5. So I'm guessing that the opportunity to try to get into the deeper underlying causes of your depression were very different because you were a little kid and probably
right.
wouldn't have been able to articulate.
Right, I started therapy when I was 5,
yeah.
though.
So your journey would have been very that might not have applied to your journey as much as other people.
Right. But I have certainly tried therapy as hard as I could and still continue to do therapy.
And what's the balance for you, Alice, in terms of the benefit you get from therapy as opposed to the medications that you're taking?
Well, I am on medications right now. My psychiatrist doesn't like the idea of me not being on medications probably ever. I think my whole life I will be medicated. But I do therapy every other week right now because I'm stable. I did do what I called a booster of ketamine after 6 months. And right now I'm at 7 months since then. And I'm doing quite well. So if I need another booster, I'm willing, but I might not.
Professor Sachs, what's the next frontier in terms of depression research? Are we looking now to different kinds of medications, different kinds of psychological therapies as opposed to psychiatric therapies? What's the next frontier in all this?
Yeah, I think it's all of the above, Joshua. And that's to say that we're coming into an era where we are learning how to run the appropriate clinical trials for these different kinds of treatments. And there are a number of truly novel mechanisms being tested, some very innovative approaches to treatment. And of course, learning how to sequence them appropriately after we learn which ones work and which ones don't work and for whom, that's where the art of this will come in.
Alice, how are you doing these days? How's life for you right now?
I'm doing very well right now. I am working consistently freelance, which was a change that I made when I was really depressed. I needed to stop being a workaholic, and I used to be a restaurant critic. And so now I am devoting myself more to writing about medicine and things like ketamine and getting the word out. But it's really great to learn to take care of myself. And that's something that I wouldn't have been able to do when I was seriously depressed. So it opened the door for me to live a normal life.
For someone who is dealing with severe depression, Alice, and is just kind of beginning their journey to figure out what would work for them, what they need to do, what would you suggest? Is there any one big piece of advice you would give them?
Research, research, research. Anything you do, I think it's important, but especially when you're dealing with your own health, you need to be your own advocate. And so I believe in visiting multiple doctors, getting multiple opinions, and really figuring out what's right for you, not right for that doctor.
And Dr. Papalos, before we go, what recommendations would you have?
I would agree with Alice. Research, 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 and get multiple opinions. I think it's and also find someone that you feel you have a rapport with, particularly if you're going to be engaging in any kind of therapy. I mean, those are the critical ingredients, I think.
And Professor Sachs, before we go, any suggestions?
Yeah, the one thing that I would add to all of that is when you're doing research, it's great to get opinions, but there's no substitute for measure-based guidance. If we were evaluating your diet and exercise plan, you'd get on a scale every morning. A doctor who can add formal measures, or you can do them on your own. This will provide some of the very best guidance for the big decisions you have to make about your treatment.
Dr. Gary Sachs, Associate Clinical Professor in Psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. Professor, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
Writer Alice Levitt. Alice, thanks for sharing your story.
Thank you so much.
And Dr. Dimitri Papalos, co-director of the Program in Behavioral Genetics at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine. Thank you, Doctor.
Thank you.
One more time, the number to the Suicide Prevention Lifeline is 800-273-8255. If you go to suicidepreventionlifeline.org, you can also chat live online. There are specific resources for youth, Native Americans, LGBTQ people. Si necesitas ayuda en español, you can go to suicidepreventionlifeline.org. This conversation was produced by Gabrielle Healy. To learn more about our team, visit the1a.org/staff. I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening. This is 1A.